everyone. This is Chris Grosso with the Indie Spirituals Podcast on the Be Here Now Network.
And my guest today is Matthew Fox. Matthew, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be with you.
Thanks. So just give you guys a very quick bio on Matthew for anyone not familiar with his work. Matthew Fox is the author of over 30 books, including Meister Eckhart, The Hidden Spirituality of Men, Christian Mystics, and most recently, A Way to God, a very wonderful book. A preeminent scholar and popularizer of Western mysticism, he became an Episcopal priest after being expelled from the Dominican order by Cardinal Ratzinger, who later became Pope Benedict the 16th? Is that correct?
16th.
16th. Mm-hmm. You can visit Matthew and learn more about his work at matthewfox.org. So again, Matthew, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you, Chris.
So I was very excited when I heard from Kim at New World Library, who's your publicist, about this new book you're doing, because I've been a fan of Merton's work for many years, like so many of us are. I actually even have a quote of one of Merton's quotes tattooed on me. I got it many years ago, and just really, he's been a very important teacher in my own life.
Great.
So I wanted to start, let's just get the obvious out of the way. What inspired you to write a book about Thomas Merton?
Well, last year was the centennial of Merton's death. I mean, birth. And the Thomas Merton Society asked me to give a talk in Louisville, where they're located, which is very near his monastery, on Merton and myself. And then I threw in Meister Eckhart as well, because Eckhart was so pivotal to Merton's conversion,
really,
and has been very important to my work as well. So in giving that talk, it was only an hour. I realized I had an awful lot more material than I could put into an hour. So out of that, I developed this book. And partly it was Merton that sent me to Paris to the Institut Catholique back in 1967 to study spirituality. And it's there that I met my mentor, Père Chenu, who named the creation spiritual tradition for me and so forth. So really, I owe Merton for all the trouble I've gotten in. So I figure I owed him something, and that's this book. But I really enjoyed doing it because I had not read Merton's journals. It only began coming out, 10 years ago or so, and really enjoyed getting into them and seeing the whole picture of Merton's journey and Meister Eckhart and myself. And so I really had a lot of fun doing it. And it was, in some ways, it was kind of a circle for me, going from my correspondence with Merton back in 1967 to this occasion to speak to his journey with more perspective, of course.
Yeah. And so talk to me a little bit about actually your relationship, your personal relationship with Merton. How did you connect with him? And I know you mentioned he's the one who sent you over to Paris, but can you talk a bit about that relationship?
Yes, I never met him personally, but we did correspond. Yeah. And I sent him a letter because my Dominican superiors had said I can go to Europe to get a doctorate in spirituality, but we couldn't agree on where I should go. So I wrote Merton, and he said go to Paris. And the Dominicans said, you can't go to Paris. I said, why not? They said, we never sent anyone to France who came home again. So I beat them over the head with Merton's letter for 3 months, and finally they relented and let me go. Then the time came years later when I think they regretted that I came home again, but that's another story. But Merton wrote me this fine letter, which I reproduce in one of the early chapters and really exegete it, because it had a lot to say about what's going on in culture. One point he makes, he says, everyone's taking LSD, everyone's interested in mysticism, but theologians aren't addressing it, he said. So I'm very happy that you're interested in that subject. That was one thing he said. He also sent me a big stack of articles of his that had not been published, notes from his teachings to the novices and others in the monastery. He said, these may be of interest to you someday. And then he died, you know, about 6 months later. So so he also, you might say, bequeathed me some very interesting documents. Of course, most of them are available in his center because he copied everything. They weren't originals, but they were part of my my appreciation to Merton for his entrusting me with his ideas. And here he was 52 at the time that I wrote him. I was about 26, half his age, and so there's something of a lineage there, I think. Again, because and Eckhart is the key to both of us.
Right.
He would write in his notebook toward the end of his life, "Eckhart is my lifeboat. Eckhart is my lifeboat." So he's telling us how important Eckhart was to him.
And I love that you, in this book, you not only write about Merton, but you bring Eckhart into it again. It might have been your last book or one of your last books that I loved the last time we spoke was For My Sir Eckhart, A Mystic Warrior for Our Time. And so, again, you bring him back in, which is wonderful. So can you talk a little bit about that connection between Merton and Eckhart?
Yes. Merton's early work was very dualistic, Augustinian, filled with guilt and shame. It comes through in his autobiography, which was a national bestseller, so millions of copies, came out in 1948, called Seven Story Mountain. And I read that when I was a 16-year-old teenager. And, you know, it affected me, like it affected a lot of people before and since, because he is very articulate. He's quite an artist in his writing. He's articulate about the contemplative life, and that was important. But in 1958, something very significant happened, and that is that Merton encountered the work of Dr. Suzuki, who, of course, brought Zen Buddhism to North America. And Suzuki kept pushing him in their correspondence to go deeper into Eckhart. In fact, in one letter, he said, "Quit quoting Cashin, who's a 6th century monk. Quote Eckhart, go deeper into Eckhart." So, of course, Suzuki was very much Merton's senior. Really, he was an elder at that time. And in fact, Merton went to visit Suzuki in New York City, which is unusual to get permission to leave the monastery. And Suzuki was 94 at the time. And they had an encounter, and Merton wrote afterwards, he said, "It's not enough to read about Buddhism or to appreciate Buddhism. You have to meet a real Buddhist like Suzuki," he said, "to appreciate the dignity of the tradition and the depth of it." So that was really a very moving tribute, I think, to Suzuki. But from 1958 on, Merton is continually quoting Eckhart. And of course, Eckhart was very prophetic. He also, of course, is deeply ecumenical. That is to say, as I point out in my Eckhart book that you referred to, I put him in the room with Buddhism and Thich Nhat Hanh. I put him in the room with Kumaraswamy and the Hindu tradition. I put him in the room with Black Elk and the shamanistic tradition and with Sufism, because really he speaks to the heart of all those traditions. That's how deep and universal Eckhart is. And so I think Eckhart had a lot to do with Merton's stretching to go east, learning the wisdom of the East, as well as to his prophetic side, because Merton was Eckhart was extremely involved in the prophetic work, the work of social justice of his time. In fact, he actually says, "The person who understands what I say about justice understands everything I have to say." Now, for a mystic, that is very strong language. And so Merton's shift from being this guilt-ridden, dualistic, Augustinian-like monk for 18 years, 1940, when he entered the monastery, to 1958, to being a real prophetic Christian from 1958 to his murder, and I know it was a murder, in 1968, he was martyred for his stand in the Vietnam War, against the Vietnam War. This shift was due in great part to Eckhart. And in all of his writings in that 10 years, he's citing Eckhart or he's echoing him. And in his second to last book, Zen and the Birds of Appetite, it's entirely really an interaction with Suzuki and Meister Eckhart. And when Merton wrote near the end of his life, "Eckhart is my lifeboat," he meant it.
Yeah. That's really beautiful. Very well said. And I love, again, going back to the Meister Eckhart book you did, I love how you put him in the room with all these other great teachers from the wisdom traditions. And then you see also that how Buddhism and Eastern traditions impacted Merton in his own life. And I love, you know, you read some of the quotes from these guys, or just their works in general, but Eckhart saying, love God is, God is a not God, not two. You know, that's very Buddhist, you know, a very non-dual
completely
stance.
Buddhist.
Yeah, I love that. And then...
and yet he never met a Buddhist in his life and never read a Buddhist book.
Right.
Which I think is so amazing. He went so deep into his own soul and into his own tradition that he found the same truths that Buddhists have found. And that's a tremendous compliment to Buddhism, of course, for finding its universal truths. But it's also a compliment to Eckhart himself that he went that deep.
Right.
And many Westerners do not realize that we have that deep a lineage as we do. But Merton helps, I think, to also represent that same depth.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So you'd mentioned earlier, you were talking about creation spirituality, which I know you write about. You say it's both a tradition and a movement celebrated by mystics and agents of social change from every age and culture, and again, called creation spirituality. So can you elaborate a bit further on that? I know there's 12 principles you write about it acknowledging. Can you talk a bit about creation spirituality?
Well, creation spirituality is the oldest source in the Hebrew Bible. It's the J source, the very first writer in the Hebrew Bible. It's also the tradition of wisdom literature in the Hebrew Bible, which scholars now agree was the tradition of the historical Jesus. And the wisdom tradition actually came late in Judaism, but it followed on the demise of the prophetic tradition. So it actually inherits the prophetic preoccupation with justice and compassion. One of the famous lines in the Hebrew scriptures is that wisdom befriends the prophets. So it's a prophetic tradition and the wisdom tradition, and it's about finding God and revelation in nature, not just in the book.
Right.
Or, if you will, in the book of nature, not just in the book that humans put together. So many scholars believe that Jesus was considered illegitimate in his village, therefore he was not allowed into the synagogue on the Sabbath, therefore he went out into the nature to pray. And, of course, we know that he spent several years as an adolescent studying with John the Baptist in the wilderness. And by the way, the wilderness in Jesus' day, Judea, included lions. It was really wilderness. So this is tradition in which Jesus comes. And it is a feminist tradition. Wisdom is feminine in the Bible and all over the world. And it cares about cosmology and nature. And it's about creativity and playfulness, like Proverbs 8 says that wisdom plays with God before the creation of the world. And it's the tradition of the great mystics that I've been trying to uncover for 45 years, people like Hildegard of Bingen in the 12th century, Francis of Assisi, who came right after her, Thomas Aquinas, Mechthilde Magdeburg, Meister Eckhart, Julian of Norwich, who follows Eckhart, and Nicholas of Cusa, about whom the late physicist David Bohm says, I owe more to Cusa than I do to Einstein, which is a pretty big mouthful from a late 20th century physicist. So I think creation spirituality really speaks to the issues today, including, of course, ecological devastation and peril, because it is about the sacredness of nature and the revelation of God through nature.
Right.
And that was Eckhart's tradition. And it became Merton's tradition, too. Also, it's very Celtic. Merton had Welsh. One side of his family was Welsh, which is Celtic. And he acknowledges that, how much he inherits from the Welsh lineage. And so it's obviously it's universal to the extent that any religion honors nature as sacred and as a source of revelation, then they are all in some way playing in the sandbox of creation spirituality.
Yeah, that's really well said. It's making me think of actually the teachings on panentheism, which I learned about actually through your work years ago. And, you know, you're mentioning nature, and I'm thinking of the transcendentalist writers like Whitman and Thoreau that also had their beautiful nature mystic experiences. But, you know, as you talk about in these teachings, how God is quite literally in all things, as all things are quite literally in God, it is a completely non-dual experience.
Exactly. And that is the heart of panentheism. You've got it. And to me, panentheism is the mystical view of the world. And just to cite one person, Mechthilde Megaberg, the 13th century Beguine, member of the Beguine movement, which was a women's movement of the 13th century, she says, "The day of my spiritual awakening was the day I saw and knew I saw all things in God and God in all things." So it's like a fish in water. The fish is in the water is in the fish. And often the fish doesn't realize that. And so with us, God is in us and all things, and we are in God, and we can miss that, especially in a dualistic or theistic naming of our relationship to the divine. And remember, atheism literally means no theism, thank you. That's what atheism means.
Yes.
So from that point of view, I'm an atheist, because I'm not a theist. Theism says we're here and God's out there someplace.
Right. Right.
But panentheism says no, there's this intimacy. Things are in God and God is in things. And Jesus talked that way too when he said the kingdom of God is within you and the kingdom of God is among you. That too is panentheistic. There's a lot of panentheism in the New Testament, and a number of people have missed this. But and John deals with it when he talks about the Christ saying, you know, I am the vine, you are the branches, and my Father and I are in you. You are in us. It's panentheistic language.
And I love that, you know, to go back to the teachings of the East, Buddhism, for example, we have these teachings of emptiness, which are often misconstrued as a nihilistic teaching, whereas all it's saying is it's empty of this illusionary separate self that we believe we are. And it, that very much to me is saying the same thing as God is in all things are in God. The language is different. But when you have the experience, whether it's through the Christian lens or the Buddhist lens, when you have that experience, there is no more lens at that point. Huh. You know, you see right through this illusion of self, and you recognize there is no subject and object. It literally is one dance unfolding in a most beautiful way, really. So.
Well, that's right. And remember, the word for spirit, in not only in the Bible, but in most languages around the world, is the same as the word for breath.
Mm.
So, breath is in us, but we're also in breath.
Yeah.
A scientist say, well, you look at the sky and see blue, that sky, the blue sky, is in us. We're breathing the sky.
Yes.
And so, once again, it's the question of what do we see, you know? And you see the effects of breath, obviously, like you see the effects of wind, but we don't see wind. We don't see breath. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Right.
So that's how spirit is. And then when it comes to mindfulness and emptiness, how can you be mindful without being mind empty?
Yes.
So the emptying is important because, and that's what the mystics call the via negativa, the emptying. And that's done in meditation. It's also done in suffering. When we lose, the great experiences of loss in our lives are emptying experiences. And they can, in fact, grow our soul for us if we see them in that context. And not just in the context of zeroing in on what we lost. Eckhart says that. He says, if you're robbed of you know, say 50 shekels or something, don't meditate on those 50. Meditate on what you still got left, you know. Otherwise, you're just going to go into a pitfall of depression, you see, that we have to meditate on what is and what is not, to kind of find that balance of emptying and filling in our lives.
Yeah. So I know we've already kind of started this conversation, but I wanted to ask you about the title, A Way to God. But before we did that, like I said, we've already talked a little about this, but God is obviously, or can be obviously, a very loaded word for some people.
Mm-hmm.
And I like where our conversation's already been going with kind of laying aside this dogmatic idea of a God, not something that's separate. So before we get into the actual title and why you named it, I'd like to explore a little bit further with you this idea of God through the lens through which you write about God.
Mm-hmm. Well, Eckhart would agree with you that God is a loaded word, and that's why one of his lines is, "I pray God to rid me of God." Yes. One of his more memorable and radical lines, you see, that we have to, that's part of the emptying, isn't it? We have to empty ourselves of our language for God, and for everything, including ourselves, because it is that letting go that allows us to sink deeper and to taste and realize. And so Eckhart has a very well-developed apophatic divinity, which is the understanding of God as nothingness. Eckhart says God is super essential darkness, who has no name and will never be given a name. So that's the emptying. How different that is from American culture that puts in God we trust on every coin and dollar bill and MX missile that we put into the world. You see, it is such a reductionism on divinity to think that we can control it and label it. So being able to let go of our projections on God, which is what really letting go of, is a very important part of growing up spiritually. And sad to say, many people do not grow up spiritually. And God for them is kind of like a Santa Claus in the sky or something. There's a personal and an impersonal dimension to divinity. And in the West, we tend to over-personalize it, I think. We have to let the mystery be a mystery. And that's what the mystics call the via negativa, the super essential darkness of God, the utter mysteriousness that gives it God no name at all. But on the other hand, we also experience God as light and as beauty and as justice and as creativity. Our work of creativity is the work of the Spirit. Just like Thomas Aquinas says, the same Spirit that hovered over the waters of the beginning of creation hovers over the mind of the artist at work. It's a beautiful affirmation of our, and we're all artists, of our powers of creativity, that we are carrying on the creative work of the Spirit that launched the whole enterprise that we call the universe. And so I think there are many faces to divinity. There's justice, there's beauty, there's creativity, there's nothingness, there's silence, and there's light as well as darkness. And Eckhart has amazing teaching when he says, all the names we give to God come from an understanding of ourselves. So we have to allow ourselves this kind of diversity too, that our beings are very profound and deep. Eckhart says, the human soul is ineffable like God is. So it's bottomless. And Merton has a beautiful poem about praying, and he says, the bottom drops out of my soul. That's just a beautiful way of talking about our infinite depths. Yeah. The bottom drops out of my soul, and from my cellar, love, louder than thunder, roars love into the world, is something like that. It's just a powerful, powerful piece. But the fact that the bottom can drop out of our souls is very interesting information. You know, yes. We're not here to guard ourselves and keep it all in and contain it. We're here to let go. And, of course, that's very Eckhartian, too, what Merton says. Eckhart says we let go from eternally. We sink eternally from letting go to letting go into God. So that's very much like Merton's saying, the bottom drops out of our soul. Divinity is to be found below, in our lower chakras, not just up in the sky.
Yeah, beautifully said. It's, as you're saying that, I'm also reminded of talking with Ken Wilber, who will often call it spirit in action. You know, spirit constantly awakening to itself and making it more available to itself. And then you get to this point where you can start to see literally everything as an ornament of spirit. You know, and that oneness, which is another beautiful way of kind of keeping oneself in alignment with the teachings.
Oh, exactly, and that's what creation spirituality is. I think that creation itself, all of nature, is continuously birthing,
yes,
and coming into being and birthing new being, and all of that carries the spirit and divinity with it.
Yeah. So let's talk about the title, A Way to God. What inspired that title?
Well, it actually came from Merton's letter that he wrote me. Mm-hmm. And here's what he said. He said, I'm glad you are going to work on spiritual theology. I do think we are lying down on the job when we leave others to investigate mysticism, but we concentrate on more practical things. What people want of us, after all, is the way to God. So I took that phrase, the way to God, and just modified it slightly as a way to God, and called the book A Way to God, Thomas Merton's Creation Spirituality Journey. But I think that the four paths of creation spirituality are really dealt with explicitly, both in Merton's words and in his practice and his living. And so he's very much an embodiment of this tradition. And as I point out in the book, I got those four paths from Meister Eckhart. And clearly, I think Merton did too, although he didn't have them explicitly named for him. I came up with that naming after Merton had died, but I got it from Eckhart. Not that he named all four by name, but that he has them there in terms of practice. And so did Merton. So I really do think that Merton's life would have been a little simpler if he had heard, for example, about the Via Creativa, about the creative path, because he was such an artist, and he was torn between his creativity and his monastic obligations, if you will. And I think by naming creativity as one of the four paths, he would have been relieved of some of his stress in that regard.
And, you know, it's interesting because I knew that Merton had that creative side, but I did not recognize the extent to which it was there. You know, as I learned through your work, he was not only a writer and a poet, but, I mean, he was also a photographer, calligrapher, and a pianist. So what do you think that Merton offered as far as the role of art in spirituality?
Well, I think number one is his writing.
Yeah.
His poetry and his prose. It's all so readable.
Yes.
He writes so richly. And, you know, it's not easy to write about the interior life. Right. It isn't. William James says one of the signs of mysticism is ineffability. In other words, the inability to talk about it.
Yeah.
But Merton is capable of putting it into words in wonderful ways. Can I share one of his poems that I really love so much?
Please do. I love it.
Great. I take great delight in this poem. He calls it First Lesson About Man. Man begins in zoology. So that I think that's his affirmation of evolution right there. He is the saddest animal. He drives a big red car called anxiety. Whenever he goes to the phone to call joy, he gets the wrong number. Therefore, he likes weapons. He knows all guns by their right names. Now, you know, this was written in the 1960s, but it's certainly relevant to today.
Absolutely.
I think of the Orlando massacre here.
Yes.
When there is no joy, there's weapons. He drives a big black Cadillac called Death. Now he's putting anxiety into space. He flies his worries all around Venus, but it does him no good. Man is the saddest animal. He begins in zoology and gets lost in his own bad news. It's an amazing poem.
It really is.
It's talking about our culture. You know, we're going into space, doing all these things. But it's also a warning that we're taking our unexamined souls into space with all this anxiety and all this joylessness and all the rest. And you know, things are not going to get brighter by doing that, you know. So it's a warning. I mean, there's so much in that little poem, but it can speak to a lot of people, even today, 60 years after it was written, you know.
Absolutely.
So that's how Merton touches us most, I think.
And that's what I love about his work, is that it is timeless. You know, he just had a way of conveying, not only in a, as you know, it's a bit humorous, it's very thought-provoking, but it is timeless, the way he presents it. What a gift, you know, to the world.
What a gift, exactly. And it's deep.
Yes, you know,
That's probably what makes it timeless.
Yeah.
It's deep. And he, at one point, you know, he criticizes the media. I mean, the Via Transformativa, the path of justice and compassion is very well developed in Merton. Of course, he took on issues like the Vietnam War and other very important issues, but in the process, he does not compromise. For example, he talks about the media. He says the media provides a Niagara of trivia. Now, this was the media in the 1960s. Imagine what he'd be saying today in 2016 about this Niagara of trivia, you know.
Yeah.
So he has this uncanny ability to really touch on the issues that are disrupting our souls, really.
He does, and that's what I love, is that he was very socially aware when it came to justice and freedom. And, I mean, he was speaking out about Martin Luther King and the civil rights activism. But not only that, he was also the first religious figure in America to speak out about the Vietnam War, which we've already talked about. And, I mean, how important that was. What an example he was setting at the time. So, you know, I know you were starting to chat about it, but I would love to hear more about, you know, what are your thoughts on Merton's perspective when it comes to justice and freedom?
And let me also point out, he was very critical of religion.
Yes.
And of fundamentalism.
Yes.
When he talked about the marriage of empire and religion, and he said how this is the destruction of religion. Even his own monks at a Easter Mass, the Easter before he died, he preached, and he talked about how many Christians, including the monks, are worshiping a wax-like Christ and you know, an idol instead of the real thing. So he didn't spare his own order, his own community, or his own religion when it came to criticizing. So his criticism was not just about culture, it was also about his own religion. And I think that's very important, that he was self-critical also, and he talked about his own shortcomings a lot. And of course, he was mentor to Father Philip Berrigan and his brother Dan Berrigan, who died just last month, at 94 years of age. And of course, they were activists who went to jail a number of times because they'd done nonviolent protest against the Vietnam War. He was close to Dorothy Day, who went to jail countless times. And they came to him for advice and for succor, a spiritual succor, if you will. And that's no doubt why he was on the watch list of the FBI and the CIA, and they were intercepting his mail and phone calls at the time, even though it was against the law to do so. It was what they had done to Martin Luther King Jr. also, of course, and both Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy and Merton died the same year, 1968. And There's really a lot of evidence now that Merton was murdered, and because of his stand on the Vietnam War. And his last talk, delivered 3 hours before he died very suddenly, was called Karl Marx and Monasticism. Now, this was not the most prudent topic for a talk in 1968 in Southeast Asia. He was in Bangkok. After all, that was the height of the Vietnam War. Now, I've spoken now to three CIA agents who were there at the time, and I asked them, did you guys kill Merton? And one of them said, I'll neither affirm it nor deny it. Wow. The second one said, we were wallowing in cash at the time in the CIA in Southeast Asia. There was no accountability whatsoever. He said, if even one CIA agent felt Merton was a threat to America, he could have had him done in with no questions asked. Wow. The third one said to me, and this person I met after the book came out a month ago, he said, yes, we killed him. And he said, the last 40 years of my life have been trying to cleanse my soul from what I did as a CIA agent for 3 years in Southeast Asia. So I think there's no question Merton died a martyr to the peace cause. And I think that's just more of the richness of the man that he paid an ultimate price for his prophetic voice and action.
It's nothing short of tragic. You know, I as you're talking about that, I'm thinking of Ramana Maharshi, and here's a person who died from cancer, and the tragedy in that to me was that had he taken a little better care of his body, he could have lived a bit longer and continued to share some more teachings with the world. Whereas with Merton, you know, it wasn't by choice, it was murder. And that's, and I can only imagine, had he lived longer, what else he, and not that he didn't bring, you know, a plethora of great things to this world, but imagine what else we could have been graced with, you know?
Exactly, because he died so young, 53 so young. And he was at the height of his powers, if you will, and he was planning on going into a more eremitical world of more solitude after he came back from Asia. But there have been so many issues since 1968 when he died, you know, that I wish he had been here to help us to discuss and debate, you know. Right. So we lost so much. On the other hand, he had intimations that he was going to die young.
Really?
Yes, he did. Furthermore, his work ethic was so profound. He worked so hard. I mean, he published 60 books. Not all of them were real long or anything, but that's a lot, and a lot of articles. But also, he had tremendous correspondence going. He had correspondence with Pasternak, with Jacques Maritain, with all kinds of poets from Latin America and so forth. He was busy with The Art of Friendship, and Joan Baez came and did picnics with him on the grounds, and a lot of other people. He was unbelievably productive.
Yes.
And we realized his letters were not email or even by computer. They were on a typewriter.
Yeah.
The guy got very little sleep because he also had his responsibilities as a monk to be praying in the middle of the night and so forth. Yeah. And so I think part of his intuition was that he was not going to live a long life. And so he wanted to, you know, get the work done before he left us. And he writes several times about his visions of dying young. So perhaps he was at least surprised of all at the age that he died.
This is true. Well, so you know, you mentioned that he, you don't have to mention, he was just ahead of his time. That is very obvious. And though he did die in 68, which was before the feminist movement really took off, you write a bit about how he was still very aware of early feminist writers and commented favorably on them. So I'd love to talk a little bit about that aspect of Merton.
Yes.
So if you can elaborate on his position on feminism.
Yes. He engaged in a lively correspondence with Rosemary Ruther. Rosemary Ruther was quite a radical Catholic feminist theologian. She was teaching at Howard University, the black university in the inner city in Washington, D.C. And they had this correspondence back and forth. And Ruther was only 29 years old. And Merton was 51 at the time. So really, it was quite humble of him to allow himself to really enter in this dialogue, because Ruther was very severe on him, actually. And but he took it. He took the criticism, and they engaged in an important dialogue. And so that's just one sign of his openness. He also, of course, was right on the button when it came to Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring, you know, the book that people say launched the ecological movement, that Rachel Carson was fired from her job as a scientist in academia for that book. And they said, this is an hysterical woman. She's worried about bunnies and trees. And Merton, on the other hand, did the opposite. He read the book. He wrote her a several-page letter saying, this is really an important book. Because of your work, he said, we're going to cease using DDT on our monastic farm and so forth. He went on and on about it. So it's just what you said. He was so alert to what was happening in the culture. But he had the spiritual discernment to realize what was really important. The women's movement was one of those things. As you say, it was just kind of getting off the ground. And he was there. And it wasn't just Ruther, but other feminist theologians that he was reading, or philosophers that he was reading. And And he was there, as I say, when the ecological issue came up. And, of course, he was there, as you said, regarding Dr. King, but also Malcolm X. He was also supportive of Malcolm X. And both of them were very controversial in the early 60s when Merton was writing about them. He did not wait for King to become a hero or something. And, of course, remember, King died the year that Merton died. And so it was more after his death, which is so often the case with prophets, that King became a heralded figure, if you will. But when things were rough and tumble, Merton was there supporting him. And he had this great, what I'd call moral intuition. And he was there to respond to the real goings-on of the times. And of course, in the 60s, there were some very significant moral movements that were going on.
Yeah.
He talks about landing at University of Santa Barbara when there was a lot of protest because of the youth protesting education in the late 1960s. And one of the leaders of the protest was a Frenchman, actually. And he asked Merton, well, who are you, this old guy in the room? You see all these ranting and raving young people. Merton wasn't speaking. He was just there. And Merton said, well, I'm a monk. And then the leader said, well, I'm a hippie and I'm a monk too. And so they got into a dialogue about what hippies and monks have in common. Right. They're both counterculture.
Right. Well, so speaking of counterculture, I mean, obviously Merton has impacted your life deeply. You know, he was a rebel for sure. And then, you know, you in your own right, I mean, being expelled from the Dominican Order is no small accomplishment. So I would love to hear more about the impact that Merton has had on you personally, in your life, in your work, and what you do.
Well, as I say, I read him when I was a teenager, and I was inspired by his vocation, his vision, the contemplative life. And I certainly read him through the years because I noticed that I quote him in a lot of my works, my book Original Blessing, for example. And I dedicate one of my early books to him and Rabbi Heschel. By the way, he was a close friend of Rabbi Heschel and of Rabbi Zalman Schachner, too, who visited him several times in the monastery. But I did not rely heavily on Merton as a theologian. Why not? I was suspicious, frankly, of what I call the Merton factory or the Merton industry. He was also, I learned when I read his journals, which came out only 25 years after his death, he criticized the monastery when he was alive for pushing him to write too much. He felt he was being used, actually, to make money for the monastery. And I felt that even after he died, the monastery kept putting out all these books of his, and I just kind of kept my distance a bit because I felt it was just too much. It was like a factory or an industry. And I just felt I had my own path I had to walk. And that's one thing that I really like, reason I like doing this book, because in a way I'm not only talking about Merton's circle of his journey, but my own and how we've our circles have intersected, because as I say, the creation spiritual tradition that has so been my work for 45 years, ever since it was named by my mentor Père Chenu, French Dominican in Paris where I studied, now I see that my work and Merton's have really overlapped a lot. But in some ways my journey has been my journey, his has been his, but we've overlapped, and especially around Eckhart and around the creation spiritual path. So I find this very, very satisfying and interesting and useful. But I really, if you look at the people I quote most, well, of course, Eckhart is a good example, of course. I use Eckhart so much. But I didn't know that Merton was also using Eckhart a lot. Because I had not really asked those questions of Merton's work, so I read him, but I did not go real hard into trying to kind of appropriate him. I was going my own path, and there was a certain independence there from Merton, you might see, in my work. But here, toward the end of my life, I'm seeing how much overlap there was. And I'm discovering things. For example, I learned in reading his journal that he praises Shenu, my mentor, time and time again. Shenu is very important to Merton because it opened up the whole political... See, Shenu is a great historian. And he talks about the end of the Constantinian era. Shenu was silenced. He was a Dominican too, like I was. He was silenced for 12 years by Pope Pius XII because he was part of the worker priest movement, which is working with the Marxist unions after the Second World War. So he was silenced. But in the Second Vatican Council, he was brought in by a third world bishop, I might say, and he was very much a part of that council. So the fact that Merton got a lot out of Shenu was really exciting to me. And so we've had these overlaps without my knowing that we had these overlaps along the way. And the role of art, again, it was Shenu who pointed out to me that the importance of creativity in art and the whole struggle for justice. And Shenu, Shenu's the grandfather of liberation theology, and as well as creation spirituality. He was a great figure, and historically speaking. And I was delighted to see that Merton knew him. And then Abbot Winandi ran a colony of hermits in Vancouver Island when I was a young Dominican, my young 20s, and I went there for a summer thinking about becoming a hermit. Well, I learned later that Merton knew Winandi extremely well, and very much he would quote him to the abbot and others about the need for the eremitical tradition to come back, etc. So that's another common figure that Merton and I shared without my knowing it until I did this book. And the same is true of Heschel. When Heschel wrote his classic work on the prophets, a big, thick book that's absolutely classic, Merton responded immediately again and said, this is exactly what we need. Well, my reading the book on the prophets early in my theological career around 1971 or so, that was very important to me too, to read Heschel and get to know Heschel better. And it turns out Heschel and Merton were very close. So we've had these intersections with common teachers, you might say, that I didn't know about till I wrote this book.
Yeah, it sounds like it was a really exciting experience for you. That's really wonderful.
It was. It's fun to see my mentors, other people's mentors, yeah, and how we intersect. You know, it's just fun.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I feel like we've had a great talk about the book, but I also acknowledge we've barely really scratched the surface of what is going on in these pages. There is so much that you covered in this book. So that said, is there something I didn't ask you to close out this conversation that you'd like to discuss that's in the book?
Well, what if I were to would give a little time here to a Merton and read another one of his passages?
I would love that.
This is a passage of the Via Positiva. The Via Positiva, the four paths in creation spirituality, and the Via Positiva is experience of God, the God of wonder and awe and beauty. And here's a passage. He says, I live in the woods out of necessity. I get out of bed in the middle of the night because it is imperative that I hear the silence of the night alone, and with my face on the floor, say psalms alone in the silence of the night. The silence of the forest is my bride, and the sweet dark warmth of the whole world is my love. And out of the heart of that dark warmth comes a secret that is heard only in silence, but it is the root of all the secrets that are whispered by all the lovers in their beds all over the world. It's just a beautiful passage, I think.
It really is.
Where Merton is, first of all, notice how non-anthropocentric it is, that he's marrying human love to the silence of the night and the love of the forest and the love of the forest for us. So he's setting human love in the context of cosmology and nature. And who could say that better than Merton? I mean, you can't top that passage for exclaiming the mysticism of lovemaking.
Yeah.
So that's Merton. And he touches us still, yes, but not only at that, the level of political criticism and consciousness, but also at this level of the intimate and the mystical and the via positiva. So I'm grateful to Merton for his articulation of what a spiritual journey really is. And he covers the depths and what Heschel called the recesses of our existence, and what I call the four paths of Christian spirituality. He touches them in with beauty and with words that awaken us and that are memorable. So I'll always be grateful.
As will I. And and I'm grateful to you for this wonderful work, and I'm sure that it will bring even more interest towards Merton's offerings to the world. So thank you very much, Matthew, not only for your time, but for writing this book. I'm sure it'll be a gift to all who read it.
Well, thank you, Chris, for your intelligent questions and conversation, and for having a program like this that allows us to talk about things that matter, like Thomas Merton.
I do what I can do. Well, no, Matthew, thank you. Have a very nice day. And again, thank you so much for your time. Greatly appreciated. Be well.
Thank you.